Let's return to This Week in America. Here's your host, Rick Bratton.
Welcome back, everybody, coast to coast, This Week in America. We've seen unprecedented advances in technology making science fiction a reality. We've never experienced change like we're experiencing now at such a pace and on so many levels. The new book, The Driver and the Driverless Car, How Our Technology Choices Will Create the Future, by Vivek Wadhawa and Alex Salkiever, weighs the potential benefits and hazards of the new technology, the moral and ethical dilemmas these breakthroughs create. The Driver and the Driverless Car is a finalist for the Financial Times McKinsey Book of the Year, one of the most prestigious competitions in business books. Also, Nature named it Best Pick Science Books in April. Alex is a writer, futurist, technology leader, former vice president of marketing communications at Mozilla, was a technology editor at Business Week, regular science contributor to the Christian Science Monitor. Alex Salkiever, co-author of The Driver and the Driverless Car, How Our Technology Choices Will Create the Future, joins us on today's This Week in America. Alex, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me on.
It is an eye-opening, fascinating book. In the beginning, you talk about advanced technology moving faster than we can absorb that offers both unprecedented rewards and unpredictable hazards. Are we adequately examining those potential hazards? We're so caught up in the rapid nature of the technology. Are we focusing on the potential hazards?
So my argument at this point would be no. There's been a lot of work towards improving the technologies, but looking at worst-case scenarios or building in fail-safes have generally been an afterthought. One example, artificial intelligence. Right now, we're seeing dramatic improvements in artificial intelligence. A couple years ago, or maybe it was a year ago, we saw for the first time a computer built by Google's DeepMind team beat the best human Go champion on Earth. Go is a very complicated game, much more complicated than chess. A couple weeks ago, we saw an artificial intelligence system from Google not only beat the world's best player or someone like that, but learn the entire game of Go on its own with almost no training data. So we're seeing AI improve very quickly, but there's very little security around AI. There's not a lot of people who are looking at how do we slow down AI that gets out of control, or how do we build in fail-safe mechanisms. There's a few people thinking about it, but it's really much more something that's an afterthought.
Well, and that's why this book is so fascinating, because suddenly we slow it down a little bit and we take a big picture look at what we're seeing. Why are driverless cars sort of the perfect metaphor for the anxiety of where this new technology is taking us?
So we chose that as the book title for a couple of reasons. First, because we live in Silicon Valley, we see driverless cars all over the place. Now they're in many other places like Phoenix, Arizona, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, but the home of the driverless car is really Silicon Valley. So we kept seeing these cars, and it was very strange because it was obvious that no one was driving the car, and even though someone was sitting in the driver's seat. And if that's the case, it begs the question, you know, what is a driver in a driverless car? Who's driving whom? Who's really in control? And what does the future mean when we're sitting in cars in the driver's seat, but the cars are driving themselves? And so for us, that was the metaphor that we used to go into deeper exploration of a whole bunch of topics around robotics, artificial intelligence, genomics, 3D printing, drones. And in all of these areas, because technology is improving so quickly, it's calling into question past assumptions we may have had, or just giving us possibilities that we may need to think through in a far more detailed fashion. And as sort of a society, we don't think we're quite prepared for that yet.
With us on This Week in America, Alex Salkiever. He is the co-author of the book Driver and the Driverless Car, How Our Technology Choices Will Create the Future. And to sort of break this down, you give us three questions that we really need to ask as we're being bombarded with this new technology. First one, does it have the potential to benefit everyone equally? And you use that as an example, for example, online education. Talk about that and why it's so important that that's a criteria that we apply in this case.
The reason why we picked that as a criteria is because we feel in the U.S. and in the developed world, we're in an era of unprecedented inequality. Haves and have-nots, not just the 1%, but the 1% of the 1% own so much more than everybody else. And so we wanted to make sure that technology didn't become something that magnified further those inequalities, because we believe that inequality over the long haul is very harmful to stability and happiness in a society. Now, the reason we picked education is because education is something that is a universal good. It should be a universal benefit. And imagine how much better the planet would be if everyone was educated, or if an Albert Einstein, who happened to be living somewhere in a country that had bad internet access, all of a sudden could learn physics from the best MIT and Harvard and Stanford professors. And so for us, education was a really good thing to look at as something that could build equality very quickly. Now, the reason we thought the technology can do this is because much of what education is delivered in the forms of books or videos or exercises, all of which can be easily delivered over the internet. And even further, we can make education smarter using artificial intelligence so that it will recognize learning styles, it will understand how people interact with avatars, and really create systems that will deliver great education to anyone, anywhere on Earth for not a lot of money. And we feel that that's something that would clearly be fostering equality for everybody, as opposed to the old system where you really had to pay a lot of money or go to a specific place or a prestigious institution to truly benefit from the top education.
Yeah, you point out that education technology has the potential to quickly spread down the economic pyramid. And the question, as I'm reading that, is, are there economic incentives for that to happen? Are you confident that it will? Because that would give everybody access to a top-notch education.
It's a really great question. So I think that there are strong economic incentives at the national levels. Most of the governments want this to happen. The way education works economically is different than many other goods, though, because it is something that is so often provided by the government, and also the payoff is so long-term. It's not like buying a car or buying a meal at a restaurant. I think that inherently people understand the economic payoff and are motivated to learn. So that's the driver that I think will be the most important thing. And at the very bottom of that, I think behind education is pure human curiosity. We talked in the book briefly about something called an experiment in India called the hole-in-the-wall computer.
Yes.
Where a group of kids in an extraordinarily poor slum were able to very quickly educate themselves using the internet and a computer. And a simple keyboard kiosk. We think that exposing people to education and to educational materials and encouraging them, even if the economic incentives aren't perfect, people just love to learn.
It's an eye-opening book. It's called The Driver in the Driverless Car, How Our Technology Choices Will Create the Future. Co-author Alex Salkever with us on This Week in America. Interesting in the beginning of the book, you've got a story of the Concorde, which you state was the future of aviation, ironically, still is the future of aviation. Talk about that, because I'm looking at that and I'm thinking, here's something that really doesn't benefit that many people. It was the future, yet it never really got off the ground.
And there was a bunch of reasons for that. It was too expensive to operate. Also, it never really went mass market. It was always something that was too expensive for normal people to have. So it became this beautiful thing which worked exquisitely well but could not survive on its own because it just couldn't get wide adoption. And granted, there are certain technologies private jets are still everywhere, of course. You know, very fancy yachts,
yes.
Things like that. But quasi-mass market supersonic transportation, was something we couldn't do with our technology then, partly because we couldn't get enough people to buy into it. Ironically, there is now a startup called Boom, which is seeking to build another supersonic airplane that will be much cheaper to build, more efficient. It takes advantage of a lot of the advances in material science. It also should be significantly quieter, which was one of the problems with the Concorde. And so, the future of aviation actually may indeed be the future of aviation. It just won't be a Concorde. So a lot of these concepts and things that we point to in the book have actually changed, but new chapters have opened on them even in the year since we finished writing the book.
One of the things you talk about, one of the three important questions, what are the risks and what are the rewards? Talk about the importance of that, because we really need to look at it from that perspective.
So couple of things I would say, one to the past, one to the present. We never really considered what were the risks and rewards of freely giving up so much of our personal data when we started using the internet, and even before then, when we allowed credit agencies to become the brokers for our identities and the repositories of most of our important sensitive information. Because this was never considered, we never thought about the risks. Then you have things like Equifax or the problem that identity theft is very rampant right now. We didn't really try to build systems that helped us better control our own fate as individuals or mitigate the larger systemic risks. Now, if you spin that forward into something around genomics, for example, we write a little bit in the book about a new gene editing system called CRISPR, which radically transforms genetic modification because it essentially gives scientists the capability to cut and paste pieces of genetic code in and out of organisms. Now, granted, you can't use it to make people smarter yet because we don't actually understand intelligence, but you can use it to, for example, create mosquitoes which might not harbor the malaria parasite. Or you can use it for a good number of genetic diseases which are caused by a single genetic mutation. So an example of that would be Tay-Sachs disease, for example, a lot of other diseases that you might have heard of, Lou Gehrig disease.
You're right.
Now, on the one hand, the genetic tools we now have can fix these problems. On the other hand, what is the potential consequence? I mean, are we necessarily unleashing other problems which may be bigger? So, for example, when you look at sickle cell anemia, on the one hand, that was something that's a huge problem. It really is a terrible illness. On the other hand, it actually affords some immunity to malaria. So there was a genetic reason why we evolved that way. Now, when you look at the mosquitoes, for example, let's say that we get rid of the malaria parasite and it's no longer on Earth. And in fact, what had happened is because malaria was there, some other parasite could not enter the ecosystem, which was far worse than malaria. And maybe that comes through because of that. So, I mean, it's not like we can just, wave a technology wand and solve a problem and expect that there won't be unanticipated consequences.
You talk about if we simply let change happen, it can steal our privacy, control everything we do by default. Talk about how we prevent that from happening. People read the book, people listen to the program and go, wow, I really need to stay on top of this. But they look at it as I'm a single voice. What can I do to maybe slow this down and look at the new technology, the pros and the cons?
So two different questions that I unpack there. One is, for example, you were talking a little about technologies taking away our identity or our choice. In a lot of ways, we should look carefully at the technology as it impacts our privacy and what's happening with our personal data as it relates to what happens with our lives. For example, if we are going to be interacting with Alexa all the time, what's happening with that data? We should know, and we should ideally ask to control it somehow. And I'm not saying that what Amazon is doing is bad or wrong. In fact, Alexa is an amazing service.
Yes.
But at the same time, we want to have more transparency as to how our data is being collected, collated, curated, and used. When you look sort of further out at more blue sky technologies, then it can be really hard for us to understand exactly what the implications might be. So in those cases, I think we need to rely more on experts who are scientists in the field to help with these kinds of things. And frankly, I think in a lot of cases, they actually do a pretty good job. So with respect to CRISPR, the scientists have been extremely vigilant about whether this could be used for modifying human embryos or, some of the thinking about if we're going to do a gene drive, which is what they would call to remove the malaria parasite from mosquitoes, can we build in a kill switch or a reverse switch, like a back button?
Yes.
I think when the experts are thinking ahead, then we all tend to do well. It's when they aren't allowed to, or the commercial incentives are so strong, that's when I think the problems happen.
A couple of minutes left in the program. We're talking about the new book, The Driver and the Driverless Car, How Our Technology's Choices Will Create the Future. Co-author Alex Salkever with us on the program. So often as I'm reading about the new technology, it basically replaces humans. What's the future of work? Where do you see this going, and how can we adjust?
It's a really, really hard question to answer right now. So I see three potential futures. One is where artificial intelligence and robotics replace large chunks of what humans do. And I'm optimistic that if that happens, then the broader benefits to society and productivity would still let us lead very comfortable lives. But then the question becomes, what do we do all day? I mean, how do we derive meaning from our lives? How do we live? A secondary possibility would be an interregnum period, sort of a long transition where robotics and artificial intelligence take over a large chunk of human jobs, and as new jobs are being created, new types of jobs, we have some social disruption and unrest, and a lot of people don't know what they're doing. We may be seeing pieces of that right now, because, as an example, participation in the U.S. labor force is fairly low by historical standards, and that's very different than unemployment. That means people who have basically opted out.
Right.
A third way would be when you look at job descriptions from 100 years ago or job titles, most of them don't exist today. And when you look at job titles today, most of them didn't exist 100 years ago. So it's clear that what we do for work is very dynamic over time. And it's possible that because human wants and needs are fairly infinite, there is no quote-unquote lump of work or lump of labor to be done. It can be ever-expanding, that because of this, there will be plenty of interesting jobs in the future that we just don't know about because we can't see them yet. And you can think of specific examples around that. I mean, 30 years ago, you wouldn't probably think that there would be a lot of jobs for people who have expertise in mapping and cartography or data visualization. And today there are, because 30 years ago, those were high priests, castes, or very, very small amounts of jobs, very technical. Today, it's something that's much more mass market, and the skills are much more in demand. So, thinking of that out that further, that might be where it heads. The one broad rule I would give, and I don't want to run too far over, is in the future, everything we do will be far more assisted by robotics and artificial intelligence than what we do today, and our jobs will probably be far more curation and collation and creation of interesting things, as opposed to rote tasks and doing routine things over and over again.
As we look at the future, it's both fascinating and scary. Are you more fascinated than scared?
I'm definitely more fascinated than scared. I'm at heart a very optimistic person, and I think that actually when we look at the kinds of things which are coming into place with technology, the lives that we'll be able to live, and not just us in the U.S., but anywhere on Earth and anybody on Earth, are going to be so much better than the lives that were being lived 50 years and 100 years ago. And I don't mean this in just a material sense. I also mean this in an emotional sense, the ability of us to spend more time with loved ones, to spend more time doing things that we love to do. Now, my one caveat, which I think this actually leads into my next book, which maybe we can talk about in a while, is that there is some risk I see of us being taken over by the technology in ways that we don't anticipate, becoming too absorbed in it. So, for example, spending too much time looking at social media, returning emails too quickly, not being able to talk to each other because we spend too much time in virtual reality or looking at our phones. So, I mean, I think that there's a creeping issue with technology taking away our humanity that we have to be very vigilant for. When you look at some of the foundational shifts like genomics, though, and driverless cars, it's very little that I can see which would be bad for us over time. I think that like driverless cars is an example. 35,000 people lost their lives in America last year. You know, if 400,000 were in car accidents that were injured, you know, it costs hundreds of billions of dollars to the U.S. economy. People are very poor at driving compared to robots. So over time, something like that, I think, is a spectacular advancement for all of us.
It's a fascinating book. It's called The Driver and the Driverless Car, How Our Technology Choices Will Create the Future. I'm really looking forward to the new book as well. This is eye-opening and fascinating, and I'm sure the new book will be as well. Co-author Alex Salkever has been our guest on the program. Alex, a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for being with us on the program.
I really appreciate you having me here. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You're listening to This Week in America online, thisweekinamerica.us.
You're listening to This Week in America with Rick Bratton. More after this.